Hi, this is Bob Sorrentino from Italian Roots and Genealogy, and I'm here today with two special guests, Joe Tuccheroni and Ben Lauricia, and we're going to talk about their great book, Italian Swindle to New York, and a little bit about their family. So welcome, Joe. Welcome, Ben.
Hello, Bob.
Hey, good to be here.
Thanks for joining me. As I said in the, when we were talking a few minutes ago, I've really, really been looking forward to this interview with you because I think it's such an important topic for all Italian Americans to hear. But before we do that, I just wanted to ask you a little bit about, your families, when they came to America and where they're from.
Ben, you want to start?
Okay. My paternal grandfather came from my paternal grandfather and grandmother came from the same town in the region of Molise, the province of Campobasso. They came from the small town of Montelongo. In dialect, it's called Mundelung. So, and then on my mother's side, both of her parents came from Capricotta. And Capricotta was very much involved in the 500-year-old transumanza, which is the longest herding industry that made that area very wealthy. Capricotta is also known for its history, its place in World War II.
My family is all from the southern part of Italy. Part of them are from Termini Imerese on the northwest of Sicily. I've also got family from Minterno, which is midway between Naples and Rome. And also I've got family from Caravelli, which is in the Molise that Ben mentioned. And finally, I've got family from Agnone, which is right across the valley from Ben's hometown of, or his family's hometown of Capricotta in the Molise. And Ben mentioned the sheep herders. Is that right, Ben?
Capricotta is noted for sheep herding, yes.
Yeah, well, I found that one of my family names from that part of Italy is Missischia, which translates to a piece of dried sheep meat.
Yeah,
that's cool. Well, Capricotta means, I believe, like sheep's head or something like that, right?
Cooked so, goat.
Cooked goat. That's right, cooked goat. So, what prompted you to look into these early Italian immigrants? And by early, a lot of people think it all started in Ellis Island, but it didn't. It started right after the reunification. So why'd you do this?
Well, Joe has a personal connection to the beginning of this research.
Yeah, Bob, about 12 years ago, I wanted to find out about my great-grandfather's saloon. He had a saloon in Ohio at the turn of the previous century, and we knew nothing about it. And so all of this research comes from my quest for his saloon. And along the way, I found that one of my great-granduncles was one of the Italians who was swindled to come to this country, which is the topic of our book.
Right. And by swindled, as you go through the book, you learn about the Padroni and before them, these nefarious people who would go to Italy and, sell tickets or with the promises of the streets are paved with gold and all of those kinds of things. So why did that start? I mean, what prompted these people to do this kind of stuff?
Well, There were conditions that came from the unification of Italy. There were three wars of Italian independence. And when the southern part of Italy was annexed to create the Kingdom of Italy, that set off a lot of shockwaves because what it did was it ended feudalism. And in feudalism, there was some stability for peasants, especially the poorest peasants. And it was a kingdom. The Kingdom of the Two Sicilies is what was defeated and annexed to the new Kingdom of Italy, to make the new Kingdom of Italy in 1861. And it was just a whole new economy, and in the new Kingdom of Italy, the leadership fell to a different social class, and it created a lot of really bad situations for the southern part of Italy, sometimes called the Mezzogiorno. And, you know, whenever there's chaos, there are always parasites. There are always people who can make a buck off of it. And there were so many changes, especially in land ownership, that a lot of the poorest peasants found themselves without the ability to attain land to till. And then they had these other impositions that they had never had before. They had the military draft for 3 years. So, you know, your youngest sons who would help you till the fields, they're taken off. There had never been a draft in the old Kingdom of the Two Sicilies. Everything now was done in money, not in promises or trade in kind. All these fields that people had lifetime leases on, they all got converted to real estate. And the new government was trying to create a modern nation and pay these war debts. So the government encouraged the development of a very aggressive real estate market. And you had a lot of people really caught unawares and just trying to cling on to life. And they figured out, well, maybe we should listen to these people who are hawking these golden dreams in America.
Right. And you know, as usual, you have the press involved, you had the steamship companies involved, you had the politicians involved, all bilking these people with promises that they knew that they couldn't keep.
Right. Yeah, Italy was a tinderbox when reunification was complete. It was a tinderbox. High taxes, no jobs. The peasants were poor, starving. They had to do something. And in the late 1860s, emigration had begun to Central and South America. And it was successful at first. The Italians found land. They found governments willing to have them come in because those new countries in South America had huge, wide open spaces, lots of farming, but no farmers. And so the Italians came in and took the jobs, and they wrote back home and said, hey, this is great. We came to work. We have jobs. We can eat. And that gradually evolved. As Ben mentioned, the parasites came in, and America was next in the crosshairs, and that's the basis of what happened.
Right. And didn't they, and you say it in the book, They told people that they were going to South America and then dumped them in New York, yeah?
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, that was one ship. That was one ship, yeah.
Yeah, what happened was the Italians thought they were going to South America because they had heard so much about South America. They thought they're going there. They're going to get great jobs. The parasites said to themselves, let's sell them tickets to South America, but send them to New York, which is a heck of a lot closer. And they saved the money that the swindlers made was on the shorter route to New York instead of sending the people to South America at a greater expense. They that's where they made their money.
And the shipping lines sold blocks of tickets in the thousands to subcontractors, and they sold blocks of tickets to other ticket sellers, sold them to others, and there was a lot of profit made off of these tickets. There's evidence that there were even school teachers and mayors and priests who were selling these tickets, and all these people, this food chain, they all were telling stories about how wonderful it would be in America. And the other thing these ticket sellers would do, they would offer predatory loans. They circulated letters, falsified letters. Some of these practices were picked up fairly early in Italy. We have newspaper accounts from the region of Molise and the official newspaper of that region saying there are fraudulent letters circulating telling people how wonderful things are in America. Don't believe these letters. So yeah. There were various ways that they pushed these people to leave their country.
Right. So now they get to America, and I think it was 1872, if I remember right.
Right. You know,
the first ships were coming in, and they dumped them. Again, we all, you know, especially those of us from New York, we all know about Ellis Island, but this was before Ellis Island, and they went to a place called Castle Garden. So I know you mentioned the book, three places in New York that most of us know about, but a lot of people may not know the connection between Castle Garden, Ward's Island, and the Five Points of New York.
Yeah, what we want to do is make a distinction between Castle Garden and Ellis Island. Ellis Island opened in 1892 as a result of Castle Garden's failure to stop the large inflow of pauper immigrants, including mostly at that time Italians. Now, Ellis Island was a federal institution. Castle Garden was managed by the state of New York. So that's a big distinction.
Yeah. Castle Garden was in the Battery, and today it's known as Fort Clinton.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. I didn't even, and I'm from New York. I didn't realize that was Fort Clinton now. Yeah. And so they're in Castle Garden, and what happens? How do they eat? What do they do?
Well, when the first shiploads came in, they overwhelmed the authorities at Castle Garden. Those authorities had nowhere to put all these hundreds of people. The immigrants basically just wandered around the lobby of Castle Garden for days on end. They had nowhere to go. And so eventually the authorities sent them to Ward's Island, which is about 8 miles up, I think it's the East River.
Yeah, the East River. Yeah, it's on the East
and
River.
And they had a huge facility where they could house people temporarily. And that's what they did with these poor immigrants. They housed them until they could figure out what to do with them.
Right, right. And the Five Points area is what we would call today, I guess, Little Italy, like Mulberry Street and
right,
that
right.
section over there.
Elizabeth Street, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, my wife's mom grew up on Spring Street in Little Italy.
Wow.
And it's unfortunately, it's not nearly the same anymore. You know, one of the neatest things that I recall from reading the book was the big snowstorm where they grabbed all the Italians to clean the snow.
Right. That was very important because it gave people a chance to work, and it also proved that the Italians were good workers and that could possibly fill a niche in the U.S. labor world, the world of work in the United States.
It also helped to turn the attitude of many New Yorkers. When the Italians first came, there was a lot of press. A lot of people complained about the greasy Italians and the worthless Italians. And then these snowstorms, one, I think it was New Year's Eve or Christmas Eve, 1872. And then 3 or 4 weeks later, at the end of January, another snowstorm. Yeah. And these Italians were recruited and they worked hard. They cleared the roads. And you could see in the news articles a change in attitude. The people were happy that these roads had been cleared. And lo and behold, these Italians had done the work. So it helped a lot.
Right. And other people were reading these accounts of people outside of New York. And so the marketability of Italians really took off.
And to help that along, Castle Garden had very recently instituted a labor exchange. where people from across the country could check in by telegraph and see if there were people available to come and work in various parts of the country. And that's how the Italians basically broke out of New York City and came to other parts of the country.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. So I know you guys are from Ohio, so that's how they started moving west to Ohio and into Pennsylvania, railroad jobs, mining jobs, and things like that, yeah?
Yeah, my great-granduncle was recruited out of Castle Garden or Ward's Island. We're not sure where he was, but he came to Ohio in January of 1873 to work in the coal mines. He was contracted by coal mine operators to come and work.
Right, and I don't think a lot of people realize that the large Italian population in Youngstown, Ohio.
Yeah, well, after the Civil War, the country continued to grow, and more and more people were leaving these homesteads and entering other kinds of employment in the mines or in the factories and all. And factory owners saw that it was in their interest to use lower paid workers. And often the Italians fell into the situation in a class called pauper labor, P-A-U-P-E-R, meaning poor labor. Chinese and African Americans and Italians were used to undercut prevailing wages. And this caused a lot of trouble in New York City because you had who was doing a lot of the work in New York City, especially on the streets, but you had the Irish, and someone would come and say, well, look, we can pay you such and such, which would have been under what the Irish were working at. And in fact, we have evidence that Italians were used as strike breakers, not only in our own local hometown area, but they were used in various places in the United States at least 30 times. And this caused a lot of ill will.
Well, let me add something to this, Ben, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
The immigrant Italians mostly did not speak English. They didn't come in with the intention of undercutting American workers. They were brought by padrones, by labor bosses who did speak English. And these immigrant Italians were told what to do, where to go. They didn't understand English. They didn't know they were undercutting the American workers. So at that time, the Italians suffered abuse because the general American public saw what was going on. But the Italian immigrants themselves were innocent. They did not know what was going on. They were simply following orders, the orders of their labor bosses.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Yeah, how would they? They would just go work over here, right? And in fact, in the book, you mentioned there were actually one or two shootouts, yeah?
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, never heard of these shootouts.
Right. And there was a lynching, too.
Yes, the lynching. Is that the one in New Orleans that you?
No.
Oh, there was another one.
This was in Liberty Township, Ohio, Trumbull County. An Italian was killed by a lynch mob. There was a scuffle between him and a few of the non-Italian, probably laid off or blackballed. Miners. This was right after a strike had failed because of the Italians. So there was a lot of hatred toward them. And it ended up that a mob surrounds the boarding house where eight Italians are living and one German. And they set fire to the boarding house. And they're waiting for people to flee the burning building to attack them. And this John Church, John Chiesa, his real name, but he was known in the press as John Church. They beat him to death. But before that happens, the German says, "This is all getting out of hand. we've got to call the constables, the police. And the crowd in unison, this is what makes it a lynch mob, the crowd in unison said, we will be the constables. In other words, they established themselves as judge, jury, executioner. And that's basically the ingredients of a lynch mob. He wasn't strung up on a rope, but he was certainly lynched.
And he was the first Italian citizen to be lynched in the United States. This was 18 years before the 11 Italians were lynched in New Orleans.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. So long before.
Yeah.
There's another really sad part about this whole story, and I don't recall what years they were, but they also were. I guess the padrones were going to Italy and getting, you know, children or musicians and basically putting them into servitude as, you know, organ grinders or slave labor. Was it just your typical just nasty people looking for a buck that just decided that this was a way to make easy money?
We'll be right back.
Italian Roots and Genealogy is proudly sponsored by Your Dolce Vita and Dawn Matera, connecting people to their purpose in life and continuing their legacy. For more information, contact Dawn at www.yourdolcevita.com.
Yeah, that actually got started. I've been collecting records, and that actually got started in the late 1850s, as far as I can tell. And so this actually precedes the swindle by a good 15, 17 years, where you'd have these poor Italian children who would be either leased or sold by their parents to these padrones, and the padrones would bring them to the United States. They'd be forced to play music on the streets. If they didn't bring home enough money at the end of the day, they'd be whipped or denied food. It was slavery in the worst. And that was escalating through the 1860s. And as we mentioned in our book, several newspapers noted that when the escalation really took off, when many of the Italian children showed up in the streets of New York, that was about the same time that the Italian consul general, De Luca, Ferdinando De Luca, was assigned to New York City. And so it's thought, never been able to be proved, but it's thought that he assisted the padrones in bringing these children to New York City. So it wasn't just a couple of random, men who were doing this. It was a sort of a well-oiled machine, possibly headed by the Italian consul general in New York City.
Yeah, and it was done by contract between the maestro, the teacher, right? Between the maestro and the parents, this was the parents were given a signed contract, and there were stipulations as to what to do if the child got sick, whose responsibility it was. At what point would it become the parents' responsibility? What would happen if the child died? But you get the idea from reading some of the case histories that many of these kids never returned to Italy, either because they died or they ran away. We have a couple of cases where they ran away and established themselves independently in the United States. But it was an international trade in Italian children. These kids could be found on the streets of all major European cities. They were known as the vagabond musicians, the little musicians, I musicisti vagabondi in Italian. It was a scandal for Italy, because here's Italy, they're a new nation, and all these people are emigrating and sending their children out. It really caused a lot of shame in Italy, and the plight of these kids and the plight of the Italians who were abused by the padrones, these questions were taken up by the Italian parliament and also became matter for diplomacy.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I guess, as a result, I guess they here they tried to control some of it through various laws, but like still going on today, 100-something years later, the laws don't work. I'm going to put up a question there from Peter Barbella, so you can see that.
Oh, let me see.
Junkman. I've heard of hucksters as well. I'm not sure. Ben, do you have any thoughts on that?
I'm just reading the question here. Census data is replete with Italian immigrants localized occupation of junkman. What can you say about this occupation? Well, junkman, that was a pretty important job. I don't think it paid very well, but it was an important job. There were valuable items that could be taken from the trash and reused, like ragman. I heard of ragman in Youngstown.
Yeah. Rag pickers.
Ragman. So the fact that that's recorded in a document, I guess this is a census document, that doesn't surprise me at all.
So I'll add my 2 cents on it. Back in, I guess going back before the 50s and 60s, but I remember when I was growing up, behind Shea Stadium, where the current Shea Stadium is today, there were junkyards there. And most of them were run by Italians. It is said that some of the people who wound up in the trunks of the cars wound up in some of these junkyards.
Oh, boy.
Because they had the machine that would push it into
the
box.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Easily disposable, yeah.
I know of it. I know of it basically from where I grew up in Queens and where Shea Stadium is, and then across from there was the World's Fair. It used to be known between World's Fairs, it was the Corona Dump. Then it became Flushing Meadow Park when they opened up the World's Fair. Then come Corona Park, it became Flushing Meadow Park. That's my little bit on what I know about it. So you highlight several interesting people at the end of the book, but there's two I want to ask about specifically. One that I did a little blog on, Giovanni Martino, and I didn't know what you put in there. I thought, like I read, that not necessarily that he survived Custer's last stand, but that he was sent with a message for help. But the story is a little bit different than that, right?
No, you got it right. He was sent for help. He was sent to tell, I think it was General Benteen, to send reinforcements. So he was the last living person to see Custer alive. He galloped off with Custer's orders to General Benteen, and it was after that that the Indians descended upon the encampment and wiped out Custer and his men.
But he was actually in a few battles with Indians, yeah?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, when he was on his way for help, right after he left Custer, he was trapped on a hilltop by a force of hostiles for I forget how long, until he was rescued.
Yeah. He was an orphan. He was left at the church in Italy.
Yes. Yeah, right.
Yeah, amazing. So his story is an incredible story. And then later on, he wound up in New York working in the subway
ticket
system.
Taker.
Yeah. incredible story.
Right.
The other person that you mentioned, and I had never heard of him, was Giuseppe Petrosino.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, very important.
Oh, yeah.
Very important. He had the wisdom to take a look at the situation between the Italian community and the police department and saw what was wrong. The police had no respect for the Italians, and the Italians felt intimidated by the police and by the Black Hand. The Black Hand was very, very prominent in the Italian community then. The Black Hand basically kidnapped people and threatened and demanded money. So what he understood was, we've got to get these two groups talking, okay? So Petrosino convinced the police department to hire more Italian-speaking police and to actually listen to the Italians and treat them with respect. And over a period of time, the Italians understood that there was a change of attitude among the police. Maybe we use the term nowadays community police, where you have actual beat officers that would walk the beat and talk to neighbors and find out what's going on, instead of just sending in police and police cars and just, you know, cruising through the area, not knowing anybody. So when the police got to know the members of the Italian community, and the Italians got to know the police, that's when some cooperation began to take place. And it changed policing in New York City. And it made it possible for Petrosino, who's often called the Italian Sherlock Holmes, it made it possible for him to track down some of these black hand kingpins.
And Bob, you may not have heard of him before, but his life story is so important that there's been at least one Hollywood movie made about his career.
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember the movie at this moment.
You know, he's a hero in Italy, too. There's a stamp in honor of him.
Yeah, now that you mention it, I kind of recall something like that. But the mob caught up with him, yes?
Yeah. He was such a good detective. I mean, we're talking about the 1890s and right at the turn of the 20th century, 1900. He was such a good detective. He unearthed the plot to assassinate McKinley. He warned the police, his superiors, about it. McKinley was told about this plot, but he ignored it, and the rest is history.
Yeah.
Wow, that's really something. And I know both. I know the cemeteries where both of them are buried. As a matter of fact, yeah. One in Brooklyn and one in Queens.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You know,
I know Calvary. One's in Calvary. The other one's in Cypress Hills, right?
I don't remember. I have to look at the book.
Yeah, I think it was Cypress Hills, which is the same place where Houdini is buried.
Oh, great.
And I know that because my father used to go there every year to take a picture of his wife waiting for Houdini to come back, and he never made it.
You know, you had a question earlier, Bob, about who was leaving Italy, you know, whether it was just people from the South. Actually, it was people from all over Italy who couldn't make. Great. He was in Palermo. Yeah. There's a tragedy involved with that, too. A newspaper reporter, I believe it was, made it public that Petrosino was in Sicily.
The police commissioner told a newspaper reporter.
He should have kept that quiet.
Right.
Oh,
and so,
wow.
You know, he's bumped off by the Sicilian mob when they found that out. They found out that he was in Sicily.
Wow, crazy.
He knew he was compromised after that story hit the papers, but he decided to go anyway.
Yeah, look at this. Yeah, there's a museum devoted to Petrosino, his hometown of Padula. Yeah.
And you might like to know, Bob, you read the book, but your viewers might like to know that the reason Petrosino is in our book is because he was one of the swindled Italians. He came to this country with his father at the age of 11 on a ship that was full of swindled Italians.
Yeah.
So he came to this country 11 years old, the victim of a crime. And who knows if that had something to do with his career.
Yeah. It's possible.
Not every ship arriving from Italy contained people who had been duped. I know this is not my family's immigration story. But it was such a concentrated period of fraud. It's basically the end of 1872 to the beginning of 1873 that it was a subject that just had to be told. It was a story that had to be told because it has so many elements that you even see today in some of the abuse that immigrants have to suffer.
Tommy from Boston had a question about the Padron system.
Did they do the same in New York? Did they attempt to stop the Padron system? That's a good question, and we address that in our book. Basically, in 1882, the Immigration Act of that year was passed basically to stop people from coming to this country who had no job. And that pretty much summed up most of the Italians coming at that time. That failed. In 1891, another immigration law was passed that was also intended to stop the illegal contracting of Italians in large numbers to this country. These were poor Italians who had no work in their own country. They were brought here by padrones. The law was passed in 1891 to try and stop the padrones from doing this, and it failed. After all, if you look at the immigration figures, Italian immigration skyrocketed in the 1890s and early 1900s. So yes, the federal government attempted to stop the Padron activity, but there was no teeth to the laws.
If you have any stories in your family that go like this, well, great-grandpa came here and he was sent to Wyoming. He was sent to this place or that place. That's language that makes me think that he was in the Padron system.
Right. I agree.
Oh, really? That's an interesting fact.
He was sent to so-and-so. Yeah. Yeah.
I did interview, one person who told me about, her family was Colorado, way back when. Yeah.
Italians in the mines, Oklahoma.
Right.
Yeah. Indian Territory, yeah.
Yeah. And building the railroads.
Right.
Oh yeah.
Right.
So what did they do in what was in Youngstown? Was it coal?
Yeah, it was coal.
Yes. Youngstown is pretty much almost devoid of industry at this point, but in the early part of the previous century they were a leader in the production of steel. It was called the Steel Valley, Youngstown area. It was called the Steel Valley. But there are newspaper articles from the late 1800s that say that before iron and steel became the dominant industry in Youngstown, its first industry was coal, because the surrounding area was honeycombed by coal mines.
And not just any coal mines. This coal was incredible. It was soft coal, which is usually a dirty coal, right? Soft coal has to be processed into coke to be used in most industrial sites, processes. But this soft coal, the old people said it was soft, but it burned hard. It had a very, very high carbon content. And it came out in convenient sized blocks. It was called block coal. Sometimes it was called Sharon block coal because the seam started somewhere near Sharon, Pennsylvania, and went under the state line. It got all played out, all mined out by the 1890s. But this is a coal that people wanted. And we exported it to, we sent it to Chicago, Cleveland. This was premium soft coal. We've had four or five very prominent early leaders of the Youngstown community. They call them I Prominenti. They all came out of the coal mines of this coal era that resulted in a strike. There was a coal miner strike in 1873, and they brought in the Italians. And many of those strike-breaking Italians ended up doing well in the Youngstown area.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
And that's another reason why Italians had such a hard time in the public's eye back then, because these Italians, they didn't speak English. They were recruited in New York City. They were told, you're going to come and work in a brand new coal mine. They brought them to Ohio. And what happens when they get off the train? They're face to face with strikers who they were meant to replace. And so that's why the Italians had such a hard go of it. They didn't know they were going to be strike breakers, but they were brought to Ohio. They had an agreement. What could they do? If they said, I'm going to break the agreement, they were poor. They had nowhere to go.
And they didn't even speak Italian. They spoke regional languages.
So, yeah, right.
You know, it was very difficult for them.
I have two more questions before we wrap. So I'm going to put them. I'm going to put Peter first, and then Julia. So here's Peter's question.
Oh, I couldn't answer that, Peter. Sorry.
Everybody in my grandmother's family, if they weren't a farmer, my maternal grandmother, if they weren't farmers, they were seamstresses. The men were farmers, the women were seamstresses.
Yeah. Well, here's a way to look at this. Okay. Before an Italian woman could get married, she had to sew, and in some cases weave, all the underwear for herself and her future husband, and the pillowcases had to be embroidered, and the sheets perhaps had to be embroidered. Every Italian woman had to do that. So that's where skills as a seamstress came into play. It was, I guess in English you call that the trousseau, in Italian that's called the corredo. They had to have all that done. And if they didn't have that done, they were practically they couldn't be married.
it was their
production that was going to support this household.
That's neat.
And by the way, Peter, one of my great grandmothers came over, and her manifest occupation was listed as seamstress. So.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of them, seamstress. Yeah.
Oh, that's a good question. I don't think the passenger list would say that they were being recruited by a padrone. I don't know. If you saw the destination was one of the mining towns, it's possible that they were involved in the padrone system.
Yeah, that's a hard one, Julia. To answer, there are many ships, voyages mentioned in hearings, in congressional hearings, that were known to be ships full of Italians brought by padrones from the 1880s and 1890s. But we would have to look at your ship in particular and try to track, see if there are any news stories about it, to see if, or any mention in congressional records, to see if in fact they were brought by padrones. But it was such a lucrative business that if you find a ship which carries a very large number of Italians, as Ben mentioned, there's a pretty good chance that it was managed by padrones.
And
yeah, especially if it's from one town, they're all from the same town.
Right.
Then you would think, well, someone's involved in this, who knows the town and who's organizing this exodus.
Right.
Well, that's interesting.
Maybe they needed somebody in the garment district, and they found out how good she was.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was a great embroiderer. My grandmother was a great embroiderer too. Yeah.
Well, and I have no idea how they started the business. My grandfather and his brother had an embroidery business in Little Italy, actually north of Little. They were on 14th Street, but they had they made bridal veils and headpieces in the 20s and 30s up until the 50s. Yeah. if I could change my picture back here, I could show it. And it didn't pop up, but oh yeah, it's behind me over here. So that's my my uncle's in. If I slide past, if I go this way,
yeah,
the guy with the straw hat is my uncle actually, and next to him, my great uncle, and next to him, where the arrow is, that's my father's brother, older brother Achille. An interesting story about that was, after, I guess, 30 or 40 years, I came across, through ancestry, my cousin Linda, and her grandmother actually had beads from my grandfather's shop, and then she gave some to my sister and my brother.
Oh, well, really nice memento, yeah.
Really, really cool.
Yeah.
Well, listen, guys, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. So for people who want to buy the book, and I'll put that out there, I'll put that out there on the replay, but for anybody who wants to buy the book, and I suggest that if you want to know about Italians, I don't know if this is going to come out the right way, but that you get this book about the early Italians that came in before Ellis Island, Italian Swindle to New York. So where can people get it?
Oh, any of the online book dealers.
Yeah. Amazon, Barnes and Nobles, I believe.
Yeah, Walmart, Target. But you probably have to order on their website.
You can even find copies on eBay.
Oh, great, great! So there's lots of opportunities to find it, and like I said, I suggest people. It's a great read, and even at the end of the book, there's actually some translated interviews with some of the people actually came off the ships.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen.
Being and talking with you and seeing your image and
thanks. I appreciate you guys being here. Like I said, it's a story that people need to hear, and not enough people know this story. So
well, thank you very much for having us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been great. Thanks.